Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today is Wednesday, January 21st, 2026. And, you know, if you've been paying any attention to the headlines or maybe just trying to update your encryption keys lately, you know, the world feels, well, it feels a little less solid than it used to.
It really does.
We are looking at a topic today that sits right on that that very uncomfortable edge between hard science fiction and urgent legal reality.
It's one of those days where we really have to ask you to just throw out about 300 years of basic assumptions about how the world works.
No small task.
Not at all. Because today we are talking about quantum law. And I know, yeah. I know that phrase sounds like something straight out of a Marvel movie.
It really does. It sounds like we should be wearing capes or something. But the thing is, as of this morning, with the release of Ralph Luzzi's new curriculum, it is very much an academic and, I think, a practical reality.
It is. And we are diving deep into class one of his new course, which is titled Quantum Foundations and Today's Breakthroughs.
Right. And I think it's really important to set the stage right here at the top. This isn't a physics lecture.
No. Absolutely not. Yeah. If you're worried about, you know, complex math or if the word eigenvector gives you hives, don't be.
Please don't be.
The mission of this deep dive, and really the mission of Luzzi's course itself, is to look at what happens when the legal system, which is built on rules, on certainty, on straight lines, what happens when that collides with the physical reality of the universe?
Which turns out to be?
None of those things. It's messy. It's probabilistic. It's weird.
And it is weird. Before we get into all the weirdness, and it does get very weird, we should probably introduce the architect of all this chaos, Ralph Luzzi.
Yeah.
If you've been in legal tech for any amount of time, you know the name. But for those who might not, who exactly are we dealing with here?
Ralph is, I mean, he's essentially a legend in this space. He was the lead attorney in the De Silva Moore case way back in 2012.
Right. I remember that. That was huge.
It was a landmark case. It basically legalized the use of AI and predictive coding in e-discovery. Before that, the whole idea of a machine helping you sort through documents was considered risky, even controversial.
He normalized it.
He did. He saw that AI wave coming a full decade before ChatGPT even launched. He was way ahead of the curve.
So he's the person who dragged the courts, kicking and screaming, into the age of big data.
That's a good way to put it. And interestingly, the source material mentions that he actually retired from active practice just this year in 2026.
Right now.
He stepped back specifically to focus on this, on building a roadmap for the next 20 years of legal technology. He's basically saying, look, AI was the warm-up act. Quantum is the main event.
I love that. And he's not just teaching it. He's using it. The notes say he built this entire curriculum with Gemini and ChatGPT as his research assistants.
Yeah, so the course itself is sort of a cyborg creation. You have the human direction and insight amplified by AI. It's practicing what it preaches.
Okay, but let's get to the why now. We're sitting here in January 2026. Why is this the moment for quantum law? Why wasn't this a big deal 5 years ago?
It really comes down to a physical wall. A wall we just slammed into in computing.
Uh-huh.
For 40, maybe 50 years, the entire tech industry, and by extension, the entire global economy, ran on Moore's Law.
We all just took it for granted.
Completely.
Yeah.
Chips get smaller, they get faster every 2 years, like clockwork. You buy a laptop, 2 years later it feels ancient, but the new one is twice as fast.
The endless upgrade cycle, we all know it well.
Well, the party's over. We ran out of room. We are literally running out of atoms to build with.
Yeah.
You can't make a transistor smaller than an atom without the electrons just quantum tunneling their way out. They jump the tracks.
So we hit the physical limit of silicon.
We did. So classical computing, the chips in the phone in your pocket, the laptop I'm using right now, they've more or less peaked.
They can't get much faster.
They've plateaued. We can make them more efficient. Sure, pack more cores in. But that exponential growth curve is dead. And that reality is what forced the pivot to a whole new paradigm. To quantum computing.
So we're moving from bits to qubits.
Exactly, from bits zeros and ones to qubits. And it's so important to understand this isn't just a hardware upgrade. It's not like going from a V6 to a V8 engine.
It's a fundamental shift in logic.
A complete shift.
Yeah.
A classical computer is deterministic. Hmm. If you put 2 + 2 into a calculator, you get 4.
Every single time.
Every single time. It is a straight, predictable line from input to output.
Yeah.
It's boring in a good way.
You want your bank account to be boring in that way.
You absolutely do. But a quantum computer is probabilistic. You don't get one hard number back. You get a distribution of outcomes.
Right.
You get a curve of possibilities and the legal system. Well, the legal system hates curves.
Oh, it despises them. It wants guilty or not guilty, liable or not liable.
It's not built for maybe or probably.
And that right there, that's the core tension we're going to explore, isn't it? The collision between a binary legal system and a probabilistic universe. Ralph calls this the end of the clockwork universe.
He does.
I want to spend a moment unpacking that phrase because it really sets the stage for everything else. It sounds almost poetic.
It's a perfect metaphor, and it's historically spot on. I mean, think about how law is taught, especially in your first year of law school. It is built from the ground up on Newtonian physics from the 17th century.
Right. Newton saw the universe as this giant perfect machine, a clock.
Exactly. Gears, springs, pendulums. Everything has a precise place and a predictable function.
And the key assumption of that clockwork universe is that if you know the position of every single gear and the speed they're all spinning, you can predict with perfect accuracy what the clock will do next.
And more importantly for lawyers, and this is the absolute key, you can rewind the clock. You can look at the past with perfect clarity, as if it were a recording.
That's proximate cause, isn't it? That's the whole ball game.
It is precisely proximate cause. Think about the but-for test in tort law. But for the defendant's negligence, the injury would not have occurred.
Every first-year law student has that burned into their brain.
That entire legal test is a time travel fantasy. It assumes that if we could just magically rewind the tape of history and pluck out that one negligent act or move, that one bad gear from the machine, the rest of the clockwork would keep ticking along perfectly and the injury just wouldn't happen.
It assumes history is a single straight line. That cause and effect are just dominoes falling in a nice, neat row.
It assumes strict inputs yield strict outputs. It's a completely deterministic worldview. The problem, as Ralph points out in Class 1, is that physics stopped believing that about 100 years ago.
So the law is operating on an OS that science uninstalled in, what, 1920?
Pretty much. Which brings us to the quantum era.
The big shift.
Right. In the early 20th century, you have these giants, Max Planck, Einstein, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg. They looked under the hood of reality, and they realized the gears, they're not solid. At the microscopic level, the universe is not a machine at all.
It's a probability cloud.
It's a probability cloud. You cannot say a particle is here. You can only say there's like a 90% chance it's here and a 10% chance it's over there. Nature itself is fuzzy.
Which leads to the most unsettling concept in the whole course, the one Ralph really highlights, the observer effect.
This is the one that always melts my brain.
Me too, every time.
It's the idea of wave function collapse. The idea is that a system exists in all of its possible states at once. It's everything it could be right up until the moment you measure it. The moment you look at it, it collapses into one single reality.
It's forced to pick one.
It's forced to pick one. And Ralph draws this absolutely brilliant parallel to the courtroom. He argues that a trial is effectively a quantum measurement.
Okay, I see where he's going with this. Before the verdict, the defendant is, what? In a state of being both guilty and not guilty.
In a way, yes. Think about a complex, high-stakes trial. You've got the prosecution's narrative. You've got the defense's narrative. You have evidence that could be interpreted 2, 3, 4 different ways. The case exists in a state of flux, a probability distribution of potential outcomes.
A superposition of verdicts.
Exactly. The jury, or the judge, acts as the observer. And when they sign that verdict form, they collapse the wave function. They force the universe of that case to choose one reality, guilty. Or not guilty.
That frames a judge not just as a decision maker, but as a kind of creator of reality. That's a heavy concept.
It is. It suggests the legal process isn't so much discovering a pre-existing truth, but rather crystallizing a probability into a hard fact.
But Ralph is careful here, right? He doesn't want us to float away in philosophy.
No, he grounds it immediately in what he calls the three realities framework. And this is crucial for lawyers, because otherwise you start thinking your coffee cup is going to disappear or teleport across the room.
Right. I need to know my coffee cup is still Newtonian, please.
Thankfully it is. Ralph breaks it down to keep us all sane. First, you have microscopic reality. That's nature's default setting. Atoms, photons, electrons, everything at that scale has always been quantum. It's chaotic. It's probabilistic.
But for lawyers, that was always invisible. It didn't affect a contract or a car accident.
Exactly. It was just background noise. Then, on the other end, you have macroscopic reality. That's us. That's the legal machine.
That's where we live.
Where we live. Newton's law still worked just fine here. If you drop a law book, it hits your foot. It doesn't float.
Okay, good.
But the game changer, and the reason we are having this conversation in 2026, is that new middle layer mesoscopic reality.
The builder's reality.
This is where the Nobel Prize in Physics back in 2025 came in, the work by Clark, Devoret, and Martinez. They figured out how to build systems that are big enough for us to see and touch. Things like artificial atoms, superconducting circuits, but that still behave quantumly.
So we dragged the weirdness up from the micro world into a world where we can control it.
We did. And that right there is what a quantum computer is. It's a machine built in that middle reality. And these machines, like Google's Willow Chip or Sycamore, are the ones that will be producing evidence. Evidence that shows up in court.
And that's why lawyers can't ignore the physics anymore.
Exactly. The evidence is now coming from a reality where Newton's laws don't apply.
Okay, so let's open the toolbox. In class one, Ralph breaks this all down into specific quantum behaviors, and he applies what he calls a law lens to each one. I love this approach because it strips away the hype and it just asks, okay, well, why does a lawyer care?
Right. Let's start with the fundamental building block of it all. Qubits versus bits.
The spinning coin.
That's the metaphor. And it really is the best way to visualize it.
Mm-hmm.
A classical bit, the data in your phone right now, is a switch. It is either on or off. 0 or 1. There's absolutely no ambiguity.
It's like a coin lying flat on a table. It's either heads or it's tails. You can look at it and know for sure.
Certainty. Binary. A qubit, on the other hand, is a coin that's spinning on its edge.
So while it's spinning, is it heads or tails?
It's both. Or neither. It's in motion. It represents the probability of being heads and the probability of being tails simultaneously.
Yeah.
That's the state called superposition.
And it's only when it stops spinning.
When you measure it.
Yeah.
That it finally lands on heads or tails. It becomes a 0 or a 1.
So what's the law lens there? Why does it matter to me as a lawyer if the computer thinks in spinning coins?
Because it fundamentally changes the nature of the answer you get. A classical computer gives you a binary answer, yes, no. A quantum computer calculates probability distributions.
It gives you a curve.
It gives you a curve. So if you ask a quantum system to analyze a really complex scenario, say a financial market crash or a structural failure in a bridge, it won't spit out, yes, factor X caused the crash. It will say there is a 99.4% probability that factor X was the primary cause, with a confidence interval of plus or minus 0.2%.
So it forces the court to deal with hard numbers instead of just adjectives. We're used to experts trying to sound certain, saying things like, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty.
This blows that up. It forces them to show their math on what reasonable means. It quantifies reasonable doubt. It puts a percentage on it. Can you convict someone at a 95% probability? What about 99.9%?
The technology forces us to define the mathematics of justice. We can no longer hide behind these vague, comfortable phrases like, to a moral certainty.
You have to look at the curve.
Wow. Okay, that leads right into the second concept, which I think is the most powerful one for understanding the sheer power of these machines. Superposition. Ralph uses the water in the maze metaphor for this.
And this is the aha moment for most people who go through the course. Imagine you have to solve a massive, ridiculously complex maze. A classical computer is like a mouse running through that maze.
A very, very fast mouse.
An incredibly fast super mouse, yes. But it's still linear. It runs down one path, hits a wall, runs all the way back, tries the next path. Even if it's checking a billion paths a second, it's checking them one by one.
It's sequential. It has to fail a million times to succeed once.
Correct. Now, instead of a mouse, imagine pouring a bucket of water into the entrance of that same maze.
The water goes everywhere, all at once.
Instantly. It flows down every single possible path simultaneously. It hits all the dead ends, sure, but it also flows right to the exit. It doesn't find the exit by being fast. It finds the exit by being everywhere at once. That is superposition.
And the implications of that are, well, they're terrifying for security, but also incredible for things like optimization.
This is exactly why quantum computing threatens all current forms of encryption. Encryption today is like a combination lock with trillions and trillions of possible combinations. The classical computer, our mouse, has to try them one by one. It would take longer than the age of the universe.
The quantum computer just floods the lock.
It floods the lock. It tries all combinations at the same time.
So the law lens here is all about capability. It's about being able to make an argument in court.
That only a quantum computer could have done this. Your Honor, only a quantum system could have evaluated this many possibilities. If you're in a lawsuit about logistics optimization, say a global shipping company is sued for inefficiency, or proving that a complex financial model was truly the best possible choice.
The quantum water finds the answer that the classical mouse simply could not reach. It couldn't even get there.
it changes the entire standard of best practices. Suddenly the question becomes, if you aren't using the water, are you being negligent by still using the mouse?
That is a multi-billion dollar question right there.
Right.
Wow. Which brings us to the really spooky part, entanglement.
Einstein hated this one. He famously called it spooky action at a distance. It just violated his entire sense of how the universe ought to work.
So what is it?
Okay, imagine you have two magic coins. They are entangled. One is in your pocket in New York. The other is in the pocket in London. You pull your coin out and flip it. Lands on heads.
Okay.
Instantly, faster than the speed of light, the one in my pocket in London will flip to tails. Every single time.
With no signal between them. No Wi-Fi, no hidden wires.
No connection at all that we can perceive. They are just perfectly correlated. They are part of the same single quantum system, even though they're separated by thousands of miles of empty space.
Okay, how on earth does this apply to law? This sounds like straight up magic, not evidence.
The law lens here is causation and contagion. Think about a classical machine like a car engine. If a single gear breaks, you can take the engine apart, point to the broken part, and say, here's the defect. This specific part failed.
Localized failure. That's easy to litigate. You sue the supplier of gear A.
Right. In a quantum system, because of entanglement, all the qubits are linked. They are all part of one giant interconnected state. If an error happens in one qubit, it isn't a local problem. It ripples through the entire system instantly.
The whole system fails together.
The whole system collapses.
Yeah.
So in a product liability case involving, say, a quantum navigation system on an airplane, you can't just isolate the one bad component.
You can't say component A failed.
You have to say the entire system state collapsed. It makes the traditional chain of causation incredibly difficult. Maybe even impossible to prove. Local errors become global, system-wide failures. It challenges the whole concept of compartmentalized liability.
That sounds like an absolute nightmare for discovery. The expert on the stand says, "Show me the defect." And the answer is, "I can't. The whole thing is the defect."
And it gets even more complicated when you try to get the answer out of the system.
Yeah.
That brings us to the next concept. Interference.
This was described in the materials as quantum sonar.
It's a good analogy.
Okay.
So let's go back to the water in the maze. The water's everywhere at once. That's great. But how do you actually find the single path to the exit?
Yeah.
You can't just look at the water. It's a mess of waves sloshing around.
Right. It's just chaos.
So you have to use interference. You design the computation to manipulate those waves so that the waves representing the wrong answers crash into each other and cancel out. That's destructive interference. And the waves representing the right answer reinforce each other and get stronger. That's constructive interference.
Like a pair of noise-canceling headphones.
It's exactly like noise-canceling headphones. You put them on, they generate a sound wave that is the perfect opposite of the airplane engine noise outside. The two waves meet, they cancel each other out, and you hear silence.
So in a quantum computer, you're canceling out the noise of all the billions of wrong answers, so the signal of the one right answer just pops up out of the silence.
That's the goal.
Oh.
But the law lens here is the classic black box problem.
Because I, as the lawyer, might not understand the complex wave mathematics you use to cancel out all those wrong answers.
But you have to ask, how is this system tuned? How do I know you didn't accidentally cancel out the truth? How do I know the noise you so conveniently deleted wasn't actually the evidence my client needed?
You're challenging the tuning of the sonar. Did you bias the interference pattern to give you the result you wanted from the beginning?
Precisely.
Let's talk about the next one. Tunneling. This one just sounds like cheating.
It really feels like cheating. In classical physics, if you roll a ball up a hill and it doesn't have enough energy to get to the very top, what happens?
It rolls back down. Gravity wins. That's the law.
It gets stuck in the valley. In quantum mechanics, that ball can simply appear on the other side of the hill. Without ever going over the top, it tunnels right through the energy barrier.
It just teleports.
Effectively, yes. And this is massive for optimization problems.
Yeah.
Imagine a business trying to find the absolute lowest possible cost for its global supply chain. A classical computer might run millions of simulations and get stuck in a local minimum. A solution that looks pretty good, but isn't actually the best one.
It's stuck in a shallow valley.
Right. It can't see the much deeper valley on the other side of the hill because it doesn't have the energy to climb over and look. It settles for good enough.
A quantum computer can just tunnel through that hill.
It can tunnel through the hill to find the deeper valley, a much cheaper, more efficient solution that the classical computer physically could not have reached.
So in a settlement negotiation, or a dispute over best execution in a financial trade, the quantum system is exploring solutions that literally did not exist for the old tools.
Correct. It finds options that were completely off the map. So the legal question becomes, if you are a fiduciary and you didn't use the tool that can tunnel through the hill to find the absolute best outcome for your client, did you fail in your duty?
Wow. But we have to talk about the catch. There's a big catch to all of this magic. The Achilles heel, decoherence and noise.
The great party pooper of quantum computing. The reality is that these delicate quantum states, the spinning coin, the water in the maze, are all incredibly ridiculously fragile.
So a little vibration hits the chip.
Or the temperature rises by a fraction of a degree, or a stray cosmic ray zips through it. Poof, the magic is gone.
The wave function collapses. The spinning coin falls over.
The water turns back into a mouse. This is why we call the current era the NISQ era. That stands for Noisy Intermediate Scale Quantum. Our machines are powerful, but they are very, very noisy. They make a lot of errors.
And the law lens here is the most obvious one of all. Reliability.
Reliability, yes, but also spoliation of evidence.
Yeah.
This is a huge, huge issue. In the classical world, if I measure a piece of evidence, if I make a forensic copy of a hard drive, I don't destroy the original. The data is still there.
You have the copy and the original.
In the quantum world, the very act of measuring the evidence changes it. It collapses the state. It's gone.
So a defense attorney says, I demand to examine the quantum state of the system at the precise moment of the crash. And the plaintiff's lawyer has to say, sorry, you can't. The act of us looking at it to get our answer destroyed it.
Preservation of evidence takes on a completely new meaning when the evidence evaporates the moment you observe it. How do you build a chain of custody for something that vanishes when you touch it?
This leads to what I think is the biggest headache Ralph outlines in class one, the verification paradox.
Yes.
If a quantum computer solves a problem in 5 minutes that would take the world's biggest classical supercomputer 10 septillion years to solve, How do you check the answer?
You can't. You can't just rerun it on your laptop using Excel. Hey, Siri, can you double check this quantum calculation for me? Siri would melt. Siri would need longer than the age of the known universe to check the math.
So we have an answer from what is effectively an oracle, but no way to prove it's the right answer using any conventional tools.
This is where Ralph introduces the concept of quantum echoes, or time reversal. And it sounds like science fiction, but it's an actual practical technique. Think of a Rubik's Cube.
Okay, I'm picturing it solved one.
Right. A quantum computation is like a machine twisting that Rubik's Cube 1,000 times in a wildly complex predetermined pattern. To check if the machine worked properly, you can't calculate every single one of those 1,000 twists. But what you can do is try to untwist it.
You run the tape in reverse.
You run the exact same operation, but backwards. If you get back to the perfectly solved cube you started with, you know the machine was working perfectly. There was no noise. If you get back to a messy, scrambled cube.
You know that noise corrupted the process somewhere along the way.
You measure the echo. Google's Willow Chip experiments were famous for doing this. They measure how much the butterflies, the chaos from noise, disturb the system's return to its original state. It's a way of checking the integrity of the process by reversing time within the system itself.
And this leads to what I think is the single most important legal concept in this entire deep dive. This is the one every litigator listening needs to write down. Fidelity versus identity.
This is the big one.
Yeah.
This will be the takeaway for every trial lawyer. If you remember nothing else, remember this phrase, because it fundamentally changes how you cross-examine an expert witness.
Okay, break it down. What's the difference?
In the classical world, our entire legal system demands identity. If I run a blood test on a sample today and get a result of 10.5, and I run the exact same test on the same sample tomorrow, I want the number to be 10.5. Identity, consistency, repeatability.
And if the number changes, you argue the machine is broken or the test is unreliable. That's a standard impeachment technique.
Of course. In the quantum world, because of the inherent noise, the spinning coin never landing exactly the same way, you will never get perfect identity. You literally cannot step in the same quantum river twice. If you run the computation twice, you will get slightly different numbers. The noise always changes things.
So I can just hear the cross-examination in my head now. Dr. Expert, you ran this quantum simulation twice, is that correct? Yes. And you got different results both times, didn't you? Yes. Then the results are fundamentally unreliable, aren't they?
And the expert has to be ready with the answer. No, counsel. Because in this domain, we are not looking for identity. We are looking for fidelity.
Fidelity. What does that mean?
It means we want to know. Did the result faithfully represent the underlying probability distribution? We aren't looking at the individual data points, we're looking at the shape of the curve.
So it's faithful to the pattern, not to the specific number that was spit out.
Precisely. It shifts the entire legal standard from truth as a point on a graph to truth as the shape of the graph. As long as the shape of that probability distribution is consistent across multiple runs, the evidence is valid.
That is a massive, massive shift in how we think about the truth. It requires judges and juries to stop thinking in concrete dots and start thinking in fuzzy curves.
It absolutely is. And to help lawyers navigate all this, Ralph gives a very practical toolkit at the end of class one. He calls it a BS detector.
We all need one of those.
We do, because let's be honest, there is going to be a lot of snake oil sold in this industry. So if a vendor walks into your office selling some new quantum legal solution, what are the questions you need to ask?
He lists four. Let's run through them really quickly. Number one is capabilities.
Right. Ask them, what is this thing doing that a classical computer literally cannot do? There's so much marketing hype out there. If they just say, oh, it searches faster, you have to ask why. Is it the water in the maze, or are you just selling me a faster mouse? If a regular server in the cloud could do it, you don't need a quantum computer.
Don't buy a quantum toaster. If it just toasts bread, use a regular toaster. Good. Number two, verification.
How is the output benchmarked? Since you can't just check it on a classical computer, what are they doing? Are they using these internal echo tests? Are they using time reversal? Show me the data. Or are they just asking you to trust the black box?
And trust me, I'm a quibbit is not a winning legal strategy. Noted. Number three, error profile.
What are the error bars? Remember, probability is not ignorance. A real quantum answer should always come with a confidence interval. We are 95% sure of this result, plus or minus 2%. If they claim they have 100% certainty, they're either lying or they don't understand their own machine.
Right. The probability is a feature, not a bug. If they're hiding the probability, they're hiding part of the truth. Okay, and finally, number four, control loop.
Who controls this black box? Is there a human actually in the loop making the final call? Or are we just rubber stamping whatever the machine spits out? And that really sets up the deeper discussion for class four of the course, which is all about AI and quantum systems.
That is a solid checklist. Capabilities, verification, error profile, and control loop. That's your survival guide right there.
It's at least enough to stop you from getting completely embarrassed in a sales pitch.
So that covers the deep foundation of class one, but Ralph also teases what's coming in the rest of the course, and frankly, some of it is downright terrifying. He talks about class two, which is about Q-Day.
Yeah, this is the harvest now, decrypt later threat. It's a very real and present danger. Ralph introduces a concept called Moskva's inequality. It's a simple formula that should honestly scare everyone.
Okay, lay out the math for us.
Simple. Let's say you have a secret. It could be national security data, corporate trade secrets, your private health records. That needs to stay secret for 20 years. That's variable X. The shelf life of your secret.
Okay, 20 years. Got it.
Now, let's say it will take you 5 years to upgrade your entire global IT system to new quantum-resistant encryption. That's variable Y. The time to migrate.
So X plus Y is 25 years. That's your total window of exposure.
Exactly. But intelligence agencies predict that a quantum computer powerful enough to break all current encryption will arrive in just 15 years. That's variable Z.
Okay.
If X plus Y is greater than Z, you have already lost.
Because 25 is greater than 15, the computer arrives before your secrets have expired and long before you can fix the locks.
Precisely. Adversaries can be harvesting all your encrypted data right now, today, and just storing it. They can't read it yet, but they're just waiting for Z, the day the quantum computer comes online, to decrypt it all. For many industries and governments, that deadline passed years ago.
That is deeply sobering. And, you know, class three covers evidence, class four covers AI plus quantum. But I want to jump to the bonus content Ralph included with the course, the fireside chat.
This is the fun part. This is where he kind of takes off the professor hat. It's informal. It's just Ralph talking about the joy of discovery. He calls it wrestling with the shadow of infinity.
It sounds less like a lecture and more like one of those late night conversations you have with a colleague after a conference, maybe after a few drinks.
That's exactly the vibe. He talks about the deeper philosophical implications. This shift from a predictable clockwork universe to one of probabilistic waves implies that reality itself might be much, much bigger than we think. He even touches on multiverse theories.
Wow.
And not as a sci-fi trope, but as one of the logical conclusions you can draw from the math. If the water really does go down all the paths in the maze at once, do all those paths actually exist in some form?
That's a heavy question.
It is. And he discusses the questions raised by quantum mechanics. There are no easy answers, and he admits that. It's about being comfortable with the mystery, with the unknown.
And he leaves the listener with this final, really provocative thought about the observer. We talked about how the observer in physics is the one who collapses the wave function. The universe is forced to decide what it is just because you looked at it.
But then Ralph turns the camera around on you, the listener.
How does he do that?
He says, in the legal system, you are the observer. When a jury walks into that deliberation room, the case is in superposition. It is a swirling cloud of guilty and not guilty. It is a probability distribution based on the evidence and arguments.
But we can't leave it like that. The system demands a verdict. It demands a collapse.
And when that jury foreperson signs the verdict form, they are the instrument of coherence. They collapse the universe of that case. They force one single reality to become true. The defendant is guilty. They have collapsed the wave.
That gives me chills. It completely reframes the entire legal profession. We aren't just people applying rules to facts. We are participants in collapsing probabilities into a single concrete reality.
It brings the humanity right back into the center of the machine. The quantum machine might generate the options, the infinite sea of possibilities, but it's the human, the lawyer, the judge, the juror, who is the one who ultimately collapses the wave. We were the ones who decide what is true.
So if you're listening to this and you want to understand how you're going to cross-examine the future, or maybe you just want to understand why your clockwork legal training suddenly feels so outdated, this course seems like the place you have to start.
It's about competence, sure, but it's much more about perspective. It's about learning to see the water in the maze.
Quantum law, from causation to probability. Well, we've only just scratched the surface of class one here. There's so much more in the actual material. But we hope this deep dive gave you enough fidelity to the subject to make you curious.
Fidelity, not identity.
Exactly. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in the next reality.